Page 241. I had in my mind to make many prayers to Allah, and also to record in the eye of my mind, in the memory of my soul, the many experiences that a man must undergo as he dangles from ropes down such a wind-torn rocky cliff. Once out of sight of my Northmen friends above, I forgot all my intentions and whispered, "Allah be praised," over and over, like a mindless person, or one so old his brain no longer functions, or a child, or a fool. In truth, I remember little from all that transpired, only this, that the wind blows a person back and forth across the rock at such speed the eye cannot focus on the surface, which is a gray blur, and that many times I struck the rock, jarring my bones, splitting the skin, and once I banged my head and saw brilliant white spots like stars before my eyes, and I thought I would be faint, but I was not. And in due time, which in truth seemed as the whole duration of my life, and more, I reached the bottom, and Bulwif clapped me on the shoulder and said I had done well. Now the sling was raised up, and the waves crashed over me and over Bulwif at my side. Now I fought to hold my balance upon this slippery ledge, and this so occupied my attention I did not watch the others coming down the cliff. Page 242. My only desire was this, to keep from being swept away into the sea. Verily I saw with my own eyes that the waves were taller than three men standing one atop another, and when each wave struck, I was for a moment senseless in the swirl of chilled water and spinning force. Many times I was knocked from my feet by these waves. I was drenched over my whole body and shivering so badly that my teeth clattered like a galloping horse. I could not speak words for the clacking of my teeth. Now all the warriors of Bulwif made their descent, and all were safe, Ethgo being the last to come down, by brute force of his arms, and when at last he stood, his legs quivered without control as a man shudders with a death-throe. We waited some moments until he was himself again. Then Bulwif spoke, "We shall descend into the water and swim into the cave. I shall be first. Carry your dagger in your teeth, so your arms shall be free to battle the currents." These words of noob madness came upon me at a time when I could endure nothing further. To my eyes, the plan of Bulwif was folly beyond folly. I saw the waves crash in, bursting upon the jagged rocks. I saw the waves pull away again with the tug of a giant strength, only to recover their power and crash forward anew. Page 243. Verily I watched, and I believed that no man could swim in that water, but rather he would be dashed to bony splinters in an instant. But I made no protest, for I was past any comprehension. To my way of thinking, I was close enough to death that it did not matter if I came closer still. Thus I took my dagger, which I jammed into my belt, for my teeth rattled too severely to grip it in my mouth. Of the other Northmen, they gave no signs of coldness or fatigue, but rather greeted each wave as a fresh invigoration. Also, they smiled with the happy anticipation of the coming battle, and for this last I hated them. Bulwif watched the movement of the waves, choosing his time, and then he leapt into the surf. I hesitated, and someone, I have always believed it to be Hergur, pushed me. I fell deep in the swirling sea of numbing coldness. Verily I was spun head over feet and sideward also. I could see nothing but green water. Then I perceived Bulwif kicking down in the depths of the sea, and I followed after him, and he swam into a kind of passage in the rocks. In all things I did as he. This was the fashion. Page 244. Upon one moment the surf would tug after him, trying to pluck him into the wide ocean, and me also. At these moments Bulwif gripped onto a rock with his hands to hold against the current. This also I did. Mightily I held to the rocks, with my lungs bursting. Then in an instant the surge ran opposite, and I was propelled with frightful speed forward, bouncing off rocks and obstructions. And then again the surge changed, and tugged backward as it had done previously, and I was obliged to follow the example of Bulwif and cling to the rocks. Now it is true that my lungs burned as if a fire, and I knew in my heart that I could not continue much longer in this icy sea. Then the surge ran forward, and I was flung headlong, knocked here and there, and then suddenly I was up and breathing air. Verily, this transpired with such swiftness that I was so surprised I did not think to feel relief, which was a proper feeling, nor did I think to praise Allah for my good fortune in surviving. I gasped air, and all about me the warriors of Bulwith set their heads above the surface and gasped likewise. Now here is what I saw. We were in a kind of pond or lake, inside a cave with a smooth rocky dome and a seaward entrance through which we had just traversed. Page 245. Directly ahead was a flat rocky space. I saw three or four dark shapes squatted about a fire. These creatures chanted in high voices. Now also I understood why this was called the Cave of Thunder, for with each crash of the surf the sound in the cave reverberated with such power that the ears ached and the very air seemed to shake and press. In this place, this cave, Bulwith and his warriors made their attack, and I joined in with them, and with our short daggers we killed the four demons in the cave. I saw them clearly for the first time in the flickering light of the fire, whose flames leapt madly with each pounding of the thundering surf. The aspect of these demons was thus. They appeared to be manlike in every respect, but not as any man upon the face of the earth. They were short creatures, and broad and squat and hairy on all parts of their bodies save their palms, the soles of their feet, and their faces. The faces were very large, with mouth and jaws large and prominent, and of an ugly aspect. Also, their heads were larger than the heads of normal men. Their eyes were sunk deep in their heads. The brows were large, and not by virtue of hairy brows, but of bone. Also, their teeth were large and sharp, although it is true the teeth of many were ground down and flattened. Page 246. In other aspects of their bodily features, and as to the organs of sex and the several orifices, they were also as men. Footnote 2. One of the creatures was slow to die, and with its tongue formed some sounds which had to my ear a quality of speech, but I cannot know if this was so, and I tell it again with no conviction of the matter. Now Bulwith surveyed these four dead creatures with their thick matted fur. Then we heard a ghostly, echoing chant, a sound rising and falling in time to the thunder, pounding of the surfs. And this sound came from the recesses of the cave. Bulwith led us into the depths. There we came upon three of the creatures, prostrate upon the ground, faces pressed to the earth, and their hands raised in supplication to an old creature lurking in the shadows. These suppliants were chanting and did not perceive our arrival, but the creature saw us and screamed hideously at our approach. This creature I took to be the mother of the Wendell, but if she was female I saw no sign, for she was old to the point of being sexless. Footnote 2. This description of the physical features of the Wendell has sparked a predictable debate. See Appendix. Return to text. Page 247. Bulwith alone fell upon the suppliants and killed them all, while the mother creature moved back into the shadows and screamed horribly. I could not see her well, but this much is true, that she was surrounded by serpents which coiled at her feet and upon her hands and around her neck. These serpents hissed and flicked their tongues, and as they were all about her, upon her body and also on the ground, none of the warriors of Bulwith dared make an approach. Then Bulwith attacked her, and she gave a fearful scream as he plunged his dagger deep into her breast, for he was heedless of the snakes. Many times he struck the mother of the Wendell with his dagger. Never did this woman collapse, but always did she stand, though the blood poured from her as if from a fountain, and from the several wounds Bulwith inflicted upon her, and all the time she screamed a most frightful sound. Then, at the last, she toppled and lay dead, and Bulwith turned to face his warriors. Now we saw that this woman, the mother of the eaters of the dead, had wounded him. A silver pin, such as a pin for hair, was buried in his stomach. The same pin trembled with each heartbeat. Bulwith plucked it forth, and there was a gush of blood. Page 248. Yet he did not sink to his knees mortally wounded, but rather he stood and gave the order to leave the cave. This we did by the second and landward entrance. This entrance had been guarded, but all the Wendell guards had fled before the screams of their dying mother. We departed without harassment. Bulwith led us from the caves and back to our horses, and then did he collapse upon the ground. Ethgo, with a face of sadness most uncommon among the Northmen, directed the fashioning of a stretcher, footnote 3, and with this we carried Beowulf back across the fields to the kingdom of Hrothgar. And all the while Beowulf was of good cheer and merry. Many of the things he spoke I did not comprehend, but one time I heard him say, "Hrothgar will not be happy to see us, for he must set out yet another banquet, and by now he is a most depleted host." The warriors laughed at this and other words of Beowulf. I saw their laughter was honest. Now we came to the kingdom of Hrothgar, where we were greeted with cheers and happiness and no sadness, although Beowulf was direly injured, and his flesh turned grey, and his body shook, and his eyes were lit by the gleam of a sick and fevered soul. Footnote 3. Lectalis. Return to text. Page 249. These signs did I know full well, and so too did the North people. A bowl of onion broth was brought for him, and he refused it, saying, "I have the soup illness. Do not trouble yourselves on my account." Then he called for a celebration, and insisted that he preside over it, sitting propped up on a stone couch at the side of King Hrothgar, and he drank mead, and he was merry. I was near to him when he said to King Hrothgar, in the midst of the festivities, "I have no slaves." "All of my slaves are your slaves," Hrothgar said. Then Beowulf said, "I have no horses." "All of my horses are yours," Hrothgar answered. "Think no more on these matters." And Beowulf, his wounds bound, was happy, and he smiled, and the color returned to his cheeks that evening, and indeed he seemed to grow stronger with each passing minute of the night. And although I would not have thought it possible, he ravished a slave girl, and afterward he said to me, as a joke, "A dead man is no use to anyone." Page 250. And then Beowulf fell into a sleep, and his color became more pale, and his breathing more shallow. I feared he should never awake from this sleep. He may also have thought this, for as he slept, he held his sword gripped tight in his hand.